Welcome to the Motoring Podcast, your weekly discussion of motoring news. This is episode 18 on Tuesday, the 12th of January, 2016. Hello, I'm Alan.
Hi, I'm Andrew.
Episode 18.
We can drink now.
We can drink. So just in small amount of celebration of that.
Cheers.
Don't know if that came down the...
I heard it.
Came down the mic properly.
I raised my glass of wine.
All right, I haven't tonight. It is a Belgian beer.
I was pretending to be sophisticated, but it's failing miserably.
I don't have any open bottles of wine.
Cheers. Cheers.
So anyway, moving on from that, absolutely stacks to talk about tonight.
We do.
We've got a load of stuff from CES that we managed to defer last week because... I don't know about you, but it felt like we were standing in front of a fire hose of press releases at this time last week.
Yeah, but it was still going on.
Still, and it was just, trying to understand what was important and what wasn't was impossible. So we've got some of that to catch up on, and we've got some Detroit show stuff as well.
Yep.
But before that, let's talk about some stuff here in the UK.
SMMT announced that 2015 was a record year for new car registrations.
Mm-hmm.
Hit 2.6 million.
Yes. Yes. So up 6.34%. Yeah, year on year. Which is quite impressive, really, isn't it? I mean, I know that we've been talking about it, and this is registrations, not number of actual sales. I'm sure at some point someone's going to point that out to it. But yeah, that's. It seems like quite a lot to me.
Yeah, that I mean, it's the fourth year of growth. it's great. It's brilliant because, you know, as we harp on almost, it feels like sometimes. But it's, you know, as we bang the drum for British manufacturing, I mean, it's great to see.
It really is. It really is. It's fantastic to see. Really, just looking at. I'm actually looking. Been looking through the numbers, and I'm having a wee look. To be honest, there's almost as many private as fleet sales, really.
Yes,
it's within a few percent, which is pretty good. It's not completely reliant on fleet.
No, fleet but it shows the importance of.
No, that's true. But the bestseller list is what actually. I mean, I know it's one of the headline figures, and we try and go through each month. And to begin with, I really wasn't sure why we did it. But now I'm really very, very fond of it. And it's one of my highlights every few weeks. But what amazed me was the Fiesta and how over the whole year, the first place Fiesta has sold as many as the fourth and fifth placed Golf and Qashqai combined.
I know. It's amazing, really.
It's really nuts.
It's a lot of cars.
It is. So the number for the Fiesta, by the way, is 133,434. Four Fiestas registered in the UK last year, which is pretty darn amazing. Best-selling British cars, the Qashqai at 60,840, British-built car, with the Mini at ninth, also British-built, 47,076.
Our friend the Mocha in at number 10, or Mocha, however you pronounce it.
I think it's Mocha. That's why you see so many in metallic brown. I think people already have that in there.
But only one, I loathe to use this word, but premium.
I knew you were going to say that.
In the brand in there with the Audi A3.
I would love to see the breakdown to see how many A3s are fleet bought and how many are private bought.
Yeah. I think we would see it. It would not be 50-50. But I think that goes for absolutely virtually not all the premium cars, though, doesn't it? I would suggest.
I think it varies as you go up. But yeah, I think it sort of flicks around. I think some stuff flicks into business as well. That third column there. Yeah, hard to say, really. I think it depends model on model and manufacturer by manufacturer quite a lot.
Yep.
But no, I thought that was quite impressive.
But there was some winners and losers, brand-wise, though, wasn't there? Because we've had a little look at the figures, dug a bit deeper.
Yes.
Into the figures. And there's some manufacturers who've had a great year. I mean, most manufacturers have announced record years or very strong sales.
Yeah, but Jeep, for example, with up 176.13%.
Particularly good year, that.
That's a particularly good year. Obviously, the Renegade and, to an extent, the new Cherokee, but probably mostly the Renegade, having a humongous impact there.
Mm. They've seen that they were missing out on the market there.
Mm.
Those small little SUV stroke 4x4 things. They've done well. I think it looks cracking little car.
Yes, it is. It's lovely. It really is. I love the rear lights with their little kind of cross in the middle of them. I think that's a really nice detail. I actually quite like it.
Mm, I'd love to have a go in one and see what it was like, actually. SsangYong also have done well.
But
I mean, it's still not massive numbers, but they've only just come out with their new Trivio, is it?
Is it not Tivoli?
Oh, Tivoli, sorry.
Slightly ashamed that I knew that.
Which, again, looks a smart car.
It's a bit misproportioned. Sorry. It's got way too much height for the wheels are too small, and there's way too much height above that front wheel, between the top of the front wheel arch and the bonnet line. You can't see me waving my arms around. I'm not sure what I'm bothering. But no, it's fine. It's perfectly decent. It's probably not going to break on you. It's not going to be that expensive. It's not going to be worth much when you come to sell it. But there's nothing wrong with it. Just because I don't like the looks of it doesn't.
Yep. But surprising one for me, and I know we were discussing this earlier, but it was Smart.
Yes.
94% jump in sales.
Yeah. I was thinking about that since we were chatting about it, believe it or not. And not only have they come out, of course, with a new 4.2, which looks like the old 4.2 had an accident with a jelly baby. But there's also the new 4.4 as well, which is the same as, well, they're both kind of the same underneath as the Renault Twingo. But there's actually a 5-door Smart, which looks and gives the impression of being a sort of traditional 4.2 size, but a bit bigger. And I'm sure that's had quite an impact. I saw a couple recently. I can't remember where now. But yeah. See loads of them in France.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But there were some losers.
Mm-hmm.
For me, Seat and Fiat, actually.
Yeah, Seat was a surprise. They were down almost 11% year on year. But actually, in sales numbers, I was amazed how many Seats are actually sold. So there's about 53,500-ish. Just me. Oh, no. Oh, wrong column, pardon me. 47,600 in there. But still more than many, many brands you would expect. More than Mazda, for example. I can't know if I see any others. it's definitely more than Dacia. Depends which way I'm going. More than Volvo. There you go. More than Volvo. 4,000 more than Volvo. Mm. So, you know, you don't. We've been, you know, people are a little bit worried about Seat's performance and sales and stuff, but you know, in volume terms, I know they're down slightly this year. They're still selling quite a lot here in the UK.
Problem they've got is that their fellow stablemate Skoda.
Yeah, it's kicking their bottom. It's
20,000 more.
Yeah. Yeah, almost 30,000 more.
Yeah, so that can't help them.
They're down 1% as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But overall, good. Very good for lots of people. there were some amazing 100% drops, but they were people who'd sold a car the year before and no longer in the UK and things like
the,
that.
The three Saabs that were registered in 2014.
Slight anomalies
or
in the old
five
data.
Mias, which amazes me even more. If you don't know what a Mia is, it's MIA, then go have a look for it on the internet. A curious little vehicle, but it seems five were registered. They may well have just been the press vehicles. I don't think I've ever seen one on the road here. I've seen them on the road in Paris. I've even got pictures. But But yeah, go have a look at that and remind yourself what that particular French oddity is or was. So, yeah.
Okay, moving on then, Alan.
Yeah, as I said, a little bit about CES. Now, there was so much stuff came out of CES in Las Vegas last week. We really found that we had to narrow it down somehow. So I set a bit of a challenge over the weekend, didn't I?
You did. I didn't like you for it.
No, I know.
Because it was all bad. It wasn't. I'm lying.
That was one of the reasons for setting the challenge in the first place. So that actually had a bit of a balance in here. I didn't have to sit here wearing a flipping tinfoil hat in sympathy. So,
or just unplug in your headphones.
No. I'll give him 10 minutes and I'll go, aha, in the background a couple of times. So the idea was that each of us would choose a good thing, a bad thing, and a wild card thing from CES. So something that we thought was good, that we really liked, that was from CES and was motoring related, something that was bad, something that really, really we just didn't like at all. And also something which was a little bit off the ball. It could be another bad thing. It could be something else good. It could just be something weird. So,
in a stroke of luck.
In a stroke of luck, we both chose the same good thing.
Does that mean that there was nothing good at CES or that we both liked it for the same reason? Well, I'm about to find out. Why did you pick it then, Alan?
I liked it not for the crazy car game, concept car body that was on it.
Yeah, that was ridiculous.
It's ridiculous, but I like it for the technology and the interesting stuff that's happening underneath and what's being promised by it.
Yes.
Are we actually going to tell people what it is?
You can, yes.
We might as well. It's the Faraday Future FF01 concept car, which is completely ludicrous looking. It really is. But what I felt was really clever and what I really liked about it was the completely modular platform underneath, what they're calling a variable platform architecture. So it's completely from the ground up. They've gone through, there's a really good film. It's not at the top on the link that will be in the show notes. There you go, Andrew, you're putting the link in the show notes. In there, you've got to scroll down a little bit until you get to the powertrain part. And there is a really nice video there, which goes through and explains how they've basically modularized their battery architecture, how they've modularized their suspension and motors, so that they can make a number of different sizes, bring those to sizes and styles of vehicle and bring them to market very, very quickly. Because essentially all they have to do is change the length, change the motors, shove a different shell over the top.
But it's what manufacturers have been trying to do with their platforms anyway, isn't it? Is that you have a set standard and then you just stretch it, shrink it to fit.
But this is really taking it to extreme.
Yes, I mean, this is brilliant. I mean, this is the way that the future. But it really is, because that's got to be the most economical way to construct a a number of cars.
Yeah. And that's what they want to do. They want to bring a range out very, very quickly. So maybe we've seen other electric car vehicles. We've seen other electric car.
Other electric car vehicle type things.
Other electric car makers, and they've taken ages to bring out a second model.
Yeah.
You know exactly what I'm thinking of. And so what these guys are trying... are trying to make sure they don't make that same mistake. They want it to be really very dynamic to be able to really respond to the market. Hmm. Do you know who their backers are, by the way?
Yeah, it's something a little obscure.
It is a Chinese based video video streaming startup, basically, or video streaming site, is what's got all the money for this. And that's who's funding it. I can't remember their name now. That's terrible. I did know earlier on whenever I was listening to something else telling me about it. But no, I this definitely was the highlight for me. I think this was one of the most, I know there were many, many other announcements, but I think this was really one of the most important things, because hopefully we're going to see this variable architecture. If we can look past the crazy video game body style.
Yeah, forget that. That's just silliness, just to make sure that mainstream press picked up on it. You know, that was just a PR stunt, but the stuff underneath is very clever and looks a brilliant idea. Hopefully they can pull it off.
Yes, I really hope so too.
Moving on then, Alan, to the bad.
To the bad.
This is your choice.
It was my choice first. Right. The thing that made me read, you know, that I read and I looked at and I was moved to issue expletives from my mouth as I read it was a press release from the sort of electronics and connectivity company Harman. So Harman, we know, we probably all think of that for headphones and for stereos and stuff, and Harman Kardon are indeed one of their offshoots, one of their subcom. But Harman unveiled this thing, this collaboration with Microsoft, which is, I just don't even know where to start.
Well, explain what they're trying to do.
Well, I was going to read out a little bit here from the press release. And it's, bring the power of Office 365 into Harman's connected car systems will provide new productivity solutions and transform the driving experience, said a Microsoft executive vice president. By ensuring that Office 365 services are seamlessly integrated with car and driver telematics and performance data, we will allow consumers to be more productive during their driving hours whilst enjoying far greater convenience, safety, and reliability. No, just no. I cannot think of anything worse, anything more dangerous, anything more stupid, and to be honest, anything more expensive when you've already got at least one device with you that can do all of this stuff. You know, they talk about, and the smug looking git in the picture in the press release, and he's having a Skype call with someone else from the car. I don't understand why these companies think A, that we want these things in our vehicles. Yes, I really want to park up and look at a spreadsheet, not on my laptop, not on my iPad, not on my work phone. No, I want to look at it on my dashboard. Said nobody ever. Okay? It's just such a why, who thing. And it's I don't know. It's just completely pointless waving, in my humble opinion.
I understand that there are unfortunate people whose office is their car, and they are that is generally where they are most of the time. However, the technology already exists that will provide them with, if they need it, Skype.
Mm-hmm.
Which they have to pull over for anyway.
Yeah, well, the thing is that really the best and safest thing for them to do is to park up at Charnock Richard Services, to get out of the car, to take a short walk, to give them some fresh carbon monoxide, to get some blood circulating in their body, so that they can then sit down onto their vitally important Skype call in the Starbucks at Charnock Richard Services and sell their physical media duplication solutions or whatever it is that they do. And do it there. That's much safer. It's much better for their health and for their mental well-being than being stuck in a car all the time. Sorry.
No, you're quite right. Because the other point to this, well, the other problem I see is productivity is used as one of the major pluses when it comes to connected and autonomous cars. Now, I can see it sort of with autonomous cars. However, when people talk about productivity and the office hours, this is all based on factory hours.
Mm-hmm.
And most people don't do factory work anymore. People are, they are information peddlers. And that requires your brain in a different way to a repetitive factory job.
It's very difficult to do time and motion in the information age.
Yeah, we're in the information age, which means that you are utilizing your brain in a different way. You have to take breaks. No one ever works flat out for their 8 hours in the office. And any company that has that fantasy in their head that that is possible and that is what should be doing deserves to go under, because that's ridiculous nonsense.
I agree.
Now, if someone is out on the road and they don't already build in times when they are stopping to do work or whatever it is, then you need to restructure how you do things. A, mm-hmm. should they be on the road anyway, or can we do all our meetings via Skype in the office
mm-hmm.
or their home? Because you look, more companies are coming on board with this idea that people don't work flat out between 9 and 5 every day or 9 and 6. Because there is now more flexible working, mm-hmm. there is working from home, although some companies are turning their back on that. It's just the way they've implemented it has been bad, and yet they've punished everyone else for it.
All sorts of organizations you wouldn't expect to be considering working from home are looking at working, looking at home working.
It's, in my opinion, working from home and that sort of thing is the way that you're going to reduce the dangers in air pollution.
Mm-hmm.
That you're going to reduce accidents on the road, that you're going to reduce
congestion,
fuel. You're going to make it easier and cheaper for your employees. Now, there's many pluses to it, but yes, it does have to be monitored and it does have to be done in a controlled manner, because there are mm-hmm. people out there that will just take the mickey and go, great, I'm at home, I'll sit in my pajamas and play on the Xbox all day. There are people that will do that, and they've always been thus, but then they'd be the sort of people that would hide in the back of the warehouse pretending they were doing an audit.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't actually want those sort of people in your organization anyway.
People who behave like that tend to find ways of behaving that way, no matter where they're meant to be working.
Yeah. So yeah. Please stop with the you're going to be more productive.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fallacy. It's a dream. It's not reality. And it's unfair on people because what you are creating the environment more and more that if you're awake, you must be working. And it's bad enough now that, you know, so many, you know, you're so easy to check your work email through your phone and everything else. And as you said before, there is nothing that's being offered there that we don't already have the solution to now without costing any more.
Yep.
And definitely no more in massive amounts of money in research and development.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Shall we move on?
Yes, we'll move on to mine.
This is a little bit of a bête noire, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. On the one hand, this should please me immensely, because what it is Bosch had revealed that they have been developing and creating haptic touchscreen technology. And that means that when you touch the touchscreen, it feels as though there's a button or a switch under your finger or fingers. Now, you will, if you have listened to me or if you have followed me on Twitter, I have occasionally muttered about how I don't think touchscreens are actually safe in a moving vehicle.
Only 3 or 4 times a week, mate.
I have been cutting it down.
I know.
But I firmly believe that a touchscreen in a moving car operated by the driver is not a safe thing, because you have to look at the screen to ensure that you're doing it right. Other people are obviously agreeing with this because Bosch have replicated the feel of buttons.
Yeah.
Now, my problem with this is how much money, time, and effort went into researching something we already have. Now, the already have are buttons and switches.
But these are magic function-changing buttons. No,
that's tosh. Nonsense. Now, I know from our Gothenburg correspondent that yes. The Volvo voice-activated mm-hmm. system is very good.
I would like, I'm looking forward to next week when I'm, because we've got a little bit of a class outing next week.
Yes.
When I'm going to, you know, in between you eating your peanut butter sandwiches and stuff, there should be a chance to try out one of these alternative UIs, which I'm looking forward to watching you try and get your head around, because you'll either love it or you'll just explode, and then we'll be faced with the cleaning bill.
Should we guess?
Inside the large executive vehicle.
Should we guess which one?
Yes.
No, I'd like to give it a go. Yes, absolutely. I'm looking forward to that. But again, I think this, they've wasted effort into fixing a problem that wasn't actually there.
Until they make it.
Because in pennies or cents already, they have what it costs. They have the technology to deal with it in something that won't fall down if the software goes wrong, because it's a physical switch or button, yeah. Something like that.
If I remember rightly, they're in cars in the UK, there has to be a physical button for your hazard light.
Oh, it's just for that occasion.
I don't know about anything else. I know that hazard light has to be a physical button that is disconnected from any of, you know, it can't be a touch screen. It can't be something like that. It has to be a button that works that. I kind of agree with you. I didn't necessarily agree until being in that Renault Espace at Christmas and New Year. When the driver was demonstrating to me how you could change all the colours of the interior lights and all these kind of things through a number of different hues.
And how much of the portion of the drive was he actually looking at the road ahead?
Well, that was the problem. That's what I'm saying. He had to keep looking at it. And it was that was kind of 1.5 car width road and pretty wiggly and bumpy, you know, through the hinterland of Burgundy. And that was the weakest link as far as I was concerned.
So it was a great real world example of why it shouldn't be allowed.
Yes. Speaking of screens in cars,
yes.
Shall we move on to my wild card one?
Yes, please.
I figured that it wasn't CES unless there was a connected refrigerator. Oh no, sorry, that's me looking at something completely different. I figured it wasn't CES unless there was an almost useless, slightly ridiculous gadget which just seemed a little bit over complex. So I figured that what really we need to talk about as my wild card was the Car Loudy from Cognitive AI Technologies. Now, this is still a Kickstarter at the minute, I believe. Or I'm led to believe from this Roadshow article from CNET. And what it is it's basically a Kindle that you Velcro to your dashboard, and it reflects in your windscreen, and it gives you a heads-up display so that you can... So basically, you don't have to buy a 5 Series, you don't have to buy an AAA, you don't have to buy any of these cars where the head-up display is an expensive option. What you simply do is plug something into your OBD2 port, which I'm sure you all know is diagnostic port that all cars have these days. Connect that through Bluetooth, connect that to your smartphone, and then pair your smartphone through Bluetooth to the Car Loudy screen, which you Velcroed to your dashboard, and then voila, that is much, much safer, and you have a head-up display of your satellite directions, of your speed, of your revs, and all these kind of things. Simple as anything. Why has nobody ever done this before?
Now, before you pile in, I think head-up displays are the future.
Yes, they are.
I know Audi has been... very clever in the way that they changed their display in the dashboard that could have the map and all sorts of stuff. And I think that was great. That was a great next move from the traditional dash layout. But I think if you do not have a fully autonomous car, the future will be a head-up display and voice control.
Just quickly, my father, he specs his BMWs with head-up displays, and he sees it as a fantastic safety feature.
Yeah,
because as an older person, he takes a little while to adjust his focus between the dials and the road ahead, whereas he doesn't have any of that issue with the head-up display. So he really likes it. He rarely looks at the dials in his car because the stuff he needs to see, so his sat-nav directions, his speed, the settings for his adaptive cruise control, because he likes all his toys, then they all show on his little head-up display, and he really likes that, and he feels it's much, much safer. He never has to take his eyes off the road. He does, but that's because he's all lazy. But he never has to take his eyes off the road. But mostly he's looking to see what kind of digger he's just passed. So but he does see it as particular. He sees it as a safety feature and one that he wouldn't be without on long journey.
No, I agree. But in this, before I took us off on a slight tangent, back to this Roadshow article. Now, this they tested a beta version, didn't they?
They did.
And it wasn't all smooth sailing, though, was it, Alan?
It wasn't. It wasn't really, no. I mean, it is still a Kickstarter project. It still has early bird pricing, so it's not perfect, but it's not the simplest thing ever to use. It's all right. It wasn't seamless, but it's not a finished product. Kickstarter early bird pricing $179, and it's expected to be $260. So by the time it gets to the UK, by the time you've got all your VAT and your duty and stuff, it's going to be about £260. And there is a site which is linked in turn from this. So it was still a beta version. It wasn't absolutely perfect, but it's better than a kick in the teeth.
Good spot.
Just thought it was fun.
Yeah. Right, my wild card.
Your wild card.
A bit more of a... It's not an exact thing. But it's how I felt the manufacturers treated CES as a motor show this year.
Yeah.
Which must have Detroit worried in future years, because cars are becoming, as we discussed briefly last week, cars are becoming more of a technology. So therefore, announcements and shows are going to be predominantly the tech side of things, because soon it'll be the outside great, it does what it does, but what does it do on the inside? And that's definitely the way people are going with it. So it was the likes that you had Ford doing again there, making major announcements. Toyota making an announcement about they've got a new research institute. They've put $1 billion, I can't remember whether it was pounds or dollars, was them. I think it was dollars.
Imagine it was dollars.
Into that, because they are aggressively targeting autonomous driving and future technology. You've got Kia pushing for autonomous cars as well.
Do you not say they had a new autonomous car drive? Yeah. Sorry.
Volkswagen virtually announced how they are now going to be an electronic or alternative fuel company.
Yeah, don't mention the diesel, folks.
Wow, lots of announcements on there. So from that point of view, I was quite surprised at how much the manufacturers had embraced CES.
I'm not so surprised about that. What I am surprised is how much news has still come out of the Detroit show.
Yes.
Actually, I'm not amazed by the amount that manufacturers have embraced CES. That's been happening over the years. A few years ago, Alan Mulally, the CEO of Ford at the time, gave the keynote speech at CES. So that's definitely been coming. What's amazed me most was how much the car stuff was talked about on tech podcasts.
Yep.
I'm going to particularly point people towards Daily Tech News Show and the episode from last week, name of which escapes me, which is mostly about car tech at CES, although it wasn't intended to be. But just how much car tech is now mainstream conversation and being reported on by mainstream, or at least by mainstream tech journalists. And that was the big surprise for me, was how much the two were merging. I mean, it is only a I know that the personal goal for me is I want my Google supplied sat nav to be able to tell my Google owned home thermostat company to be able to tell, so that when I press navigate to home, then it will automatically turn my thermostat back on, so that the house is nice and warm by the time I get home. And I know that that's the kind of joke about CES, is, you know, you've got everything connected and your connected refrigerator and stuff.
Yes. But
I was amazed just how much the car tech and the motoring tech was being looked at by the mainstream this year. That was the big, big change.
Yeah. But you've mentioned Detroit. Should we move on?
Oh, that was smooth.
We were nearly smooth.
Hmm. Yes. So speaking about homes. Oh, God, it's going to be bad. Speaking of homes, homes have vacuum cleaners, and so does the new Chrysler Pacifica. Yes, Chrysler Pacifica. Let's start off with that. So, we're all aware of the Chrysler Voyager. It has been a big old bus for a long, long time. I don't think it can't be sold in the UK because Chrysler sold zero cars in the UK last year, according to the spreadsheet in front of me. But yeah, the Voyager is finally being replaced. And it's going to be in the US anyway, where it was already the Chrysler Town and Country. It is going to be replaced by the Chrysler Pacifica. Brand new from scratch up, I believe. Available with a number of... Oh, gee. Words are escaping me now. A number of trim levels, number of engines. That's the one. Including a hybrid. It's actually quite a good-looking beast as far as sort of big boxes for carrying people around.
Yeah, right.
Come on. Sorry, was that yeah right in agreement, or was that
no,
yeah right
not in agreement?
It's not bad looking for a big box. It is essentially a shed on wheels, and it's a good looking shed on wheels.
The very front of the nose isn't too bad.
Well, there's only so much you can do with four sides of the way it rests the way back.
Yeah, well, you know my feelings on MPVs.
I know your feelings on MPVs, so I knew that this was always going to be the case. In the US, you'll be able to get a 3.6 liter Pentastar. V6. The hybrid will have two electric motors, which are both capable of driving vehicles' wheels. So I don't know if it's a parallel or an inline. Might well be parallel. But they're selling it as the first electrified minivan. Not sure Nissan will quite agree with that one. Loads of technology. There's the Uconnect Theater Entertainment. Which has a number of screens around to keep the sprogs quiet whilst you're traveling. Just everything that you'd want if you wanted a minivan, all in something that really isn't that bad looking for essentially a slightly aerodynamic shoebox. I quite like it.
Oh.
Don't know that I'd ever own one.
God.
Hopefully not. But it's not bad. And it's well worth mentioning, given that Renault, you know, there's the two fathers of the MPV. There's Renault with the Espace on one hand, and there's Chrysler with the Dodge Caravan, Chrysler Town and Country, at the other end. And so it's both have relaunched recently, and one has gone very much towards the smaller, more compact, and the other way has gone, let's make this bigger and better. And it's funny how it's forked. Should we move on?
Yes.
Do you want to move on to something that whilst I've just praised the looks of the Pacifica, something which really is fantastically handsome in my...
Yes. Although, how much your opinion counts now, I'm not so sure.
You're a harsh man, Clue.
God, dear. But you are correct in this instance. We are talking about the unveiling of the Volvo S90. And as I've mentioned Volvo S90, I must mention Polestar. Release a Polestar, please. And subliminal, no one will notice.
That sounds really dodgy through these headphones, by the way.
Well, I'm trying all ways in which to encourage Volvo to release a Polestar, Vish. But yes, the Volvo S90, which we have talked about in the past, this looks a proper, credible alternative to the German choices. Mm-hmm. We hope it does fantastically well. It is bound to be superbly comfortable. It's going to have the same voice control and all the interior gizmos as the XC90, which is still getting praise upon praise.
I love what looks like that satin finish, wood on the inside, and the way that it is. There's a term for it. The way it's symmetrical. Is it book bound? Something like that. Where it's symmetrical along the axis of the car. So hence it forms really nice kind of chevrons and stuff in that center console. Mm-hmm. I mean the pictures on the Volvo website, it's got that pale interior. Seats look fantastically comfortable. It just looks great. That Thor's hammer in the headlamps to make that nice distinctive look. It's big though. It's bigger than a 5 or any. So it is a large car. It is pushing the upper edge of that particular.
The E-Class isn't exactly small, so.
No, well, I don't know. Well, that's the current class, not the new one, which looks just like the S-Class or the C-Class. But kind of shrunk or lengthened, depending on which way you're going, and who cares? It just looks like a Mercedes. So something like this, which is distinctive and slightly different, really floats my boat anyway.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm looking forward to seeing the smaller Volvos. That's all I'm going to say. I can't wait till this works its way down the range, because the current range looked great. But the ones that are more my size and the ones that I'm more interested in. Looking forward to that picture.
Yeah, I agree. Moving on, though.
Moving on. This one is definitely one for me. Well, one dragged up by me. The new Infiniti Q60 Coupe. I saw the Q60 concept last year at Geneva. It was a good looker. Okay. I think it's just as good looking in the flesh in the real one. It's got proper size wing mirrors. It's got slightly smaller wheels, but not much smaller. I think it looks great. It's a replacement for my last car, which is the G37. It's going to have a 3 liter twin turbo V6 in there instead of that 3.7 liter.
Ding. Ooh, gee, drink.
Ding. Oh, it's so unfair. It's so unfair. You yawned first, but it was on. Wasn't being recorded.
There is
Only on your computer. There's also a 2 liter 4-cylinder turbo engine as well, which I would imagine we're going to get here in Europe, given that that's been a major issue in the past. I think it's just a really good looker. It's like the G37 has been to the gym, lost a bit of weight, become a bit more sinewy and a bit more toned in all the places where it should be more sinewy and more toned. Cracking. Really?
Yes, I think I'm quite liking what Infiniti are doing now. They seem to have got some... They've got a stronger design language now.
It's less blobby.
Yeah, it's not so melted.
Yeah.
It looks good.
The saloon's really suffered from meltedness until the Q60 came along, in all honesty. I think that looks great. I think it's one of those things that needs said is whilst we complained about the Frankfurt Motor Show being nothing but blooming SUVs, it seems that people have really been saving the saloons, they've really been saving the coupes for the Detroit show. And I think that's which is nice. It's nice to see, because I was getting a wee bit depressed and a wee bit worried by Frankfurt whenever I reeled off that humongously long list of all those SUVs.
But talking of coupes, you spotted another one.
There's another one. Right. I can't decide which of these two is better looking. I'm inclined towards the Infiniti, although from what I've seen on Tinterweb, certain comments on Autocar, comments on Twitter, the world is pretty much split between these. You either love them or you hate them. And this was the LC500 Coupe. Lexus were very clear to me in a reply to a tweet I made last night. kind of, well, I wasn't expecting a reply, but kind of saying, well, is this a Sora or is this a Supra? And they said, well, actually, it's not a replacement for anything. We see it all on its own. And they are saying that this basically is the result of response to a concept last year, the LC concept. And it is quite something. It's really is. I mean, they're pitching it towards that sort of BMW M6, Maserati GT, the sort of 80, 90 grand mark. It's not as going to be nearly as crazy as an LFA, but it's going to be a pretty good substitute by the looks of it. Great looking thing. Loads of edges and surfaces and things.
At the moment with Lexus, though, I struggle with the grill. Really struggle with the grill. It seems so vast. It reminds me of a Predator, but seems so vast at the moment. I'm worried children will be sucked up into the engine bay.
I will eat your children. I agree. I think that this is the best implementation of it yet. I really don't like it on the new RX, pardon me. I think it's a bit much. I would rather the pre-facelift version.
But other than that, I like the look of this. If they could just tone the grill thing down a bit. I don't know, maybe a bar across the middle or something. But just...
I think I would be sort of trying to attack grill with a can of plaster dip or something to just make it a bit less obvious, a bit of the old matte black on there to just try and lessen the full Bane look at the front there. I like it. I think it's the best implementation of that grill. I think it's one of the best implementations of Lexus design language since the LFA.
Okay. Yep. Moving on. Another one you spotted.
Maybe. It's one that you were keen to talk about.
Well, I think we should talk about it.
I think it's worth it. Yeah, definitely. It's the... Obviously, that means I'm talking about it. It's the 2017 Chevrolet Bolt. Now, I did say Bolt, not Volt. So Volt was the four-door saloon that was also sold over here as the Vauxhall and Opel's Ampera.
We've got one of those local to us, actually.
I like them. They were dear.
I thought they looked nice.
Me too. But they didn't seem to grab the hearts and minds of the fleet, sadly. I think they're a little bit ahead of their time, rather than anything wrong with the vehicle itself.
Ding.
Oh, you want to notice. So I was hoping you weren't going to make me speak. No, it is a 60 kilowatt hour electric hatchback. Basically, I mean, it is similar to the Nissan Leaf. I think it's a little bit bigger, but yeah, the range is really what's killing this. This is really what's boosting this. This has. Oh, let me just make sure I'm right. I'm slightly doubting myself, folks.
Isn't it supposed to have a 200 mile range?
Yes, that's what I was.
Isn't that the big figure that was being bandied about? Which is why it's grabbed people's attention is because it's one of the first cars to have a range of this.
Yeah, it's the size of the battery pack. I think is really what's pushing it there and what gives it the ability to have that range. So yeah, it's for the pushing a 200 mile range there from essentially a family size hatchback, and that's much better than the. 100 and they're just over the 100 miles now, aren't they, for the Leaf, the latest version?
Yeah,
but this has it's about twice as big a battery. I think it's the new Leaf is 30 kilowatt.
Yes, I think so.
And this is 60 kilowatt. So hence, you're looking at about twice that. So you're looking at 200 mile range.
But it doesn't matter. Well, you yawn because you were going to because it's not coming to the UK.
Yeah. Sadly, the Ampera and the Volt didn't sell well enough over here. Probably decided it's not worth engineering it for right-hand drive as well, although surely it's easier to. an electric car for right-hand drive than the internal combustion one. But it's a good-looking wee car. I really hope it's a success, and that it drives a bit more. So, yep.
Yep. Moving on.
Moving on. Moving on was... Oh, God, gee.
Now, you put this in because you weren't sure what it's really for.
Okay. I put this in. Yeah. I was flicking through. I came across press release today by Ford. And it's for something called Ford Pass. Okay. And I don't know what it is. I don't know whether I've got this in here because it's a really confusing press release, or because this is a really good idea, or because it's a really bad idea that's going to disappear in 18 months with nobody using it. But Ford are introducing Ford Pass registered trademark. And they're describing it as a platform that reimagines the relationship between automaker and consumer. Ford Pass aims to do for car owners what iTunes did for music fans. Ford Pass members can talk to personal mobility assistants, Ford guides, night or day, to help resolve their mobility challenges. If you're drunk and you can't walk, then that's what you do. Whether finding a more efficient way to get around or booking parking before reaching their destination. Members can also reserve and pay for advanced parking, virtually build their ideal vehicle at one of several Ford hubs, and receive rewards for Ford Pass membership loyalty. Why? It's another one of these why questions. What's different between this and OnStar from GM, which has been around for a long, long time, and I would think that was worth doing, Ford would have caught up, done it years ago.
Well, I think with all these manufacturer-originated systems, that from the outside, and I will be investigating this further, because there will, this infamous, nay, almost mythical connected car episode that I mentioned now and again, I will be talking to manufacturers starting next week.
He is working on it, folks. I know he is.
To put together this show. But from the outside, it appears that the manufacturers are trying to control the internet in a similar way to how Facebook has, where Facebook is the internet for many, many people.
But why would I not just be organized? And if parking's bookable, book it in advance anyway.
I don't know that they are going to have to make... Well, I have that problem with virtually all the technology that is mentioned about connected cars and everything else. My phone can do almost everything that is being sold as a plus point for having a connected car. But I don't want to go on to that now.
No, I know.
I'm saving that for the show. But that's to that argument, we could go, you know, we could go backwards on many levels. So they are going to have to make this, they're going to have to make such a big, it's going to have to be a no-brainer for people to go, yeah, I'll use the Ford, or I'll use OnStar, or I'll use theirs, or I'll use this other one, rather than, actually, tomorrow I'm going on this trip, so I'll just book my car park by my car parking app,
yeah,
and I'll just... and I've got Waze open, so that tells me when there's accidents, and it'll take me around that, and that's open source already and doesn't cost me anything. And then there's this and that and the other. So they're going to have to... I mean, this was just the release of the idea. So they've got plenty of time to build up to it, but if they're going to go in for this and they're going to spend the sort of money that you will have to spend to make this work, then they are going to have to make this so good that people just go, oh yeah, of course I use that.
There's a couple of things here, one of which launches in April in the US, but Ford hubs are going to open in New York, London, Shanghai, San Francisco. First hub in New York, London to follow as the first European hub. And I've just noticed a little line down here which I hadn't noticed before. And it says, a Ford Pass membership is free for Ford vehicle owners and non-owners alike. So there you go. Any of us, in theory, can use it.
Mm.
That's quite interesting to me. That means it might be worth trying.
Okay.
I just didn't really understand how it was like iTunes as well. Does it install a bloated piece of software which wraps up my computer?
No, I think that, well, that's what iTunes has become. No, I think it's part of Ford's recent statement in the last couple of weeks, which is, no, we are going to shake up innovation ourselves. We're not going to let someone from outside.
Mm-hmm.
We within the industry are going to decide what the future is. We're not letting outsiders come in and disturb it, whatever the phrase is.
Interestingly, they did hold this one and announce it in Detroit, unlike the Sync 3 announcement, which was in which was at CES. But yeah, so there we go. Anyway, that's coming. Ford Pass will be around at some point. We can all try it, see if we like it, see if it works for us.
Right.
Next. Oh, yes. Yes,
this is down to me.
Down to you. This is your fault.
Yes.
This is your fault. Over the weekend. And bad timing.
Over the weekend, I was driving to visit my mother-in-law, and a cyclist was not using a dedicated cycle path next to a dual carriageway. Mm-hmm. This caused, even on a Sunday, caused quite a bit of stupidity from drivers, so that wasn't per se the cyclist's fault. However, if the cyclist had been on the cycle path, then people who, because there seems to be an epidemic in this country of people only able to see just to the end of their bonnet and then react to something rather than see ahead. So instead of people diving into outside lanes to get around cyclists, which was amazing, I was amazed they were actually trying to give the cyclists room, because normally drivers don't do that.
No.
And I thought, well, if this had been rush hour and it had been raining and it was, you know, and it was dark, this could have been a nasty situation. So I put out that, isn't it wonderful? Along the lines of, don't you just love it when a cyclist completely ignores the cycle path, the perfectly good cycle path when on a dual carriageway. Now, I got measured response to this, not somebody claiming I was being a cyclist hater or anything like this, but this was...
You were, what you don't know, or you didn't at the time, was that someone here had just been out on his bike, done a few miles around the local countryside, not on cycle paths, because there aren't cycle paths around here, because why bother? And so I was all super pro cycling that time, so I just put out my bike, was still pumped on endorphins. So I was one of the people that responded.
Yes,
but if I was that angry with you, I could actually just phone you.
And I appreciate the fact that people responded it was a bit inflammatory what I said. However, it wasn't bad, mate. I wasn't saying all cyclists are idiot or anything. And so the response I got back was a measured grown-up response, which was, look, hang on, it's not as simple as that. You know, it's not easy for the cyclists either. And @mindful_man, passed on a article, which will be in the show notes, talking about why cyclists... explaining why cyclists use the road rather than the cycle paths.
Yeah.
Which a lot of it was... Now, I've read this a couple of times now, and I can see where the author of this article is coming from.
Can I butt in as well?
Go on, then.
Okay. So before we move on to this article, which focuses on the bike superhighway in Yorkshire, it's worth pointing out that when you're on many modern bicycles these days, and many of these cycle paths are marked as cycle paths, but they really share the pavement, then even a slightly lardy, not very fast git like me can reach well over 20 miles an hour on my bike, going along on the flat, not even downhill, but on the flat, quite easily hold 20 miles an hour. And by the time you're at 20 miles an hour, and if you're meant to be riding on some kind of shared space set up with pedestrians, then you find pedestrians wandering along with dogs on a lead, with, you know, just waddling gently, because that's how they move around the place. And they're going 2, 3, 4 miles an hour. And there's a significant differential in speed just there. And you've been given about, 2 feet wide in which to work and in which to sort of manage some of that. So you're trying to make decent progress, trying to do this. And in theory, you're meant to be on this cycle path, which is this narrow lump bit of tarmac shared with pedestrians. And it doesn't work. When it's like that, it simply doesn't work. It's fine if you're wandering along at a couple of miles an hour, but there are times when you think, the speed differential here is so great, I am much safer to the world in general by cycling on the road, which is maybe a 30, for example. In which case, there's not that much of a speed differential. It might be 40, there's a bit more of a speed differential, but it's still only a factor of 2, as opposed to a factor of 7, 8, 9, 10 between the bicycle and the pedestrians. So when it comes to those shared spaces, which is slightly different from what we're about to talk about, then if I'm making progress on a road bike, then you know, I don't do it very often, but I personally prefer cycling on the road. I feel it's much safer for all involved.
Okay, I hear your statement, and I can see the sense in that. In the instance that caused me to tweet, dual carriageway was 60 miles an hour.
I am not disputing the
instance. No, I know you're not. But I'm just trying to give the background to why I was annoyed. The dual carriageway speed limit was 60 miles an hour. The cycle path is a purely dedicated cycle path with a separate pedestrian walkway that is about 10 foot away from that, of which there was no one on it. Down the whole length of it, there was no one on either of them.
Yeah.
I understand what you're saying, and I can see the sense in that totally. Yeah, you don't need a lead wrapped around your front wheel all of a sudden when you're nipping along.
Yeah. Well, you've got to try and find a balance between nipping along and doing 3 miles an hour, which on some bikes is much, much harder than you might think. It's fine on shoppers, but it's harder on dedicated road bikes.
Yeah. Yes, but sorry. So moving back to this, the article that we provided was about the bike superhighway that was built in Yorkshire. Now, the main gist of this argument, as I see it, now I'm willing to be willing for you to say that I'm wrong about this, Alan, but the main gist I can see of this argument is that the asking cyclists to stop at junctions to check if there's cars is not a good thing.
No, you're missing the point.
Good. Tell me am I missing the point, because that on the surface, that's what it looks like.
Yeah. So, here's the deal. With the image that you'll see, if you care enough to open up this argument, you'll see that there is a road there is a minor road, 2 lanes, comes out to join a much more major road, and you'll see that there's a two lane cycle path. So one going away from where the camera is, and one coming towards where the camera is. And whilst the minor road comes out, what it does is it dissects those 2 lanes of cycle path. And what's tricky here, and why people are, why I can imagine people aren't using it, is because actually the cycle path is really part of the more major road that the minor road is joining. Okay. It is traffic. Bicycles are vehicles that are going sort of to and from the camera. And all of a sudden, they're finding that actually they're going along what they believe is a dedicated path, and then there's a giveaway in there. So what you're actually doing is you're treating a form of vehicle as it. You're sending very mixed messages here, because actual fact, the minor road is joining the major road. The bicycles are on the major road, or the more major road, and so suddenly they have this giveway and they have to suddenly pull to a stop. Now, that is flipped around from how it is on most of the continent. Okay, if you go to Denmark, Sweden, France in many cases, the Netherlands, all these places, then actually you'll find that because they're part that the cycle paths are essentially lanes that are part of that more major road, then the driver coming out of this more minor road that's joining it would actually have to stop and pause and give way a little bit further back to allow the bicycles to be treated as part of traffic.
So what about the cars on the main road turning into the minor road?
They have to give way to the bicycles.
Okay. That doesn't seem sensible to me.
I can see
the sense on stopping this from the minor road into the major. I can totally see that.
There's an added complication here that they've put two different directions of cycle lane on one side of the road because it's probably easier, cheaper.
What
you find the continent is the one. There's a cycle lane going one way on one side and a cycle lane going the other way on the other side. So to be honest, you're checking for traffic coming from that direction anyway. That's another flaw with this design here. So if you see it in Sweden, if you see it in Denmark, any of these places, then actually it works because they are seen as a coherent part of the traffic. And maybe it's just people being used to it, but it is like that. And to be honest, if I was faced with this setup, I would probably use the road as well. And the reason I would use the road is because it's actually safer than going along, jam your brakes on it. Go along, jam. It's frustrating. It's annoying. It's also significantly less
you're alive.
Safe.
By stopping, you are alive. If, as a pedestrian, I do not presume I can walk out into the road, and yet, by the setup you're saying, I am part of the major road. See, that's where I disagree with it. I can see the sense in what you're saying. Now you've explained it to me about the smaller road into the major road. They have to stop further back.
That's my major
fine
on this. To be perfectly
I would not be asking someone from in a car in the major road to have to stop to let the inside lane carry on.
I have a similar thing.
What
to be honest,
saying,
mate. To be honest, mate, I actually figure that the pedestrian should have priority at that particular setup as well. Got to remember that I do use all three. Okay, well, incredibly keen.
Yeah,
no, I know.
This is definitely
nice
not an anti anyone on this.
No, I know.
But
I know.
It is that each one of the users of the road there, the pedestrian, the cyclist, and the motor vehicle, or the driver. Each one of those is of the opinion that they are the most important.
I believe
and that's the problem.
That is a large part of the problem. As I say, you know, and I refuse to defend cyclists everywhere because you go to London and I'm a pedestrian and quite frankly, the cyclists are a menace and at least once every couple of weeks, I want to kick one of the off their bikes for just being arrogant people who give the rest of us a bad name. There are factors for all of those. I mean, that design is particularly bad, partially because actually the other way around works everywhere else. And maybe it's because I'm more used to seeing it work the other way around in other countries and other parts of Europe.
We seem to have an epidemic in this country as well that if somebody is turning left off a road, the car behind will not slow down. In the last 3 months, there's been four occasions where I have had to slam on as I was turning left because there was things blocking in the road that I could not see until I started the manoeuvre. And people have veered around me and tooted horns. I thought, that's because you didn't slow down when I was in the middle of a manoeuvre, and then you had no ability to, or you had very little ability to deal with the fact that I didn't just swing into the road and move on and leave the road free for you.
We can't do that
with other cars. There's no way anyone is going to pay any attention to a cyclist inside them.
No. And the thing is, mate, that I can't. I'm not long back from France and driving there for 2 weeks. Okay. And once again, I got back to the UK and I just despaired at drivers' abilities to not be able to look past the front of their bonnets and to anticipate what was happening and all these kind of things. And I'm never going to argue that I'm a great driver. I have many, many flaws in my driving. But it's just so flaming frustrating. Lane discipline, anticipation, all these kind of things. Just shocking in this country. Sorry, you've got me on one of mine there. but yeah, I mean...
I'm thank you for explaining what this was about.
There should be a consistency around the way this stuff is implemented. There isn't. It's a problem because it's confusing for everyone. But if something is a superhighway, it seems to be designed as part of a major piece of road, then you would expect that all types of vehicle that are essentially on that type of road would be treated in the same manner as far as priority is. There we are. That's it. I'm done.
Okay.
Finished.
Yep. Right, you've explained it to me. I don't fully agree with you, but I know it now.
I don't fully agree with you either, but at least we're somewhere. We're somewhere in between and we're somewhere.
Better appreciating each other's point of view.
Yes.
And sometimes that's the best you can hope for.
If I survive.
Oh dear, I don't mean to kill you.
One last thing to lighten the mood, I don't know if these pictures have been around for a while, but there were pictures from the inside of I've lost it now. There we go. I saw it from Motorpunk magazine on Twitter. Their number one prediction for automotive design prediction for 2016 was that Harris Tweed will be the new Alcantara. Okay, as a Scot, I think that's fantastic.
You do realise that this will be in the show notes, everyone, but the grey version is in your favourite car.
It's not my favourite car. Well, I understand what it's in a Khan variation on the Land Rover Defender. I know that, and that I am completely aware of that. That did not miss me for a fraction of a second. The red one also, by the way, is in a Defender too.
Yes.
You look at those quality British Leyland door snibs and column stalks that are visible there.
Massive wing mirrors.
Just shocking. Anyway, yes, they'll fall off in a minute.
I still want one.
I don't want one at all.
But you'll happily look at mine when I come and visit.
Shut up. I really, really like that grey tweed on those Recaros. I think it looks fab. I really like this idea.
A bit of red, and it'd be in a Mark One Golf, wouldn't it?
Almost, yeah. But this is furrier than that.
Okay.
I remember one of my first time in my first job, we got to the annual design review cycle where we just sat down, three of us, and tried to come up with as many product ideas as we could in a week. And I came up with the idea of covering products with tweed. That was dismissed out of hand by my boss, who said, furry products. Who wants furry products?
You're ahead of your time, Alan.
That's what's always stuck with me with Harris Tweed. I still love the idea. Yes, absolutely indestructible as a fabric. For those of you who aren't aware of it, it's a fine Scottish tradition, hand woven on the Isle of Harris. It's Harris Tweed. And one of the selling points is you can poke a pencil through your tweed jacket and then you can make that hole disappear again. It's that well woven.
I shall remember that for all my pencil poking needs.
Tweed jacket, part of my school uniform. So, yes, I'm going to see the tweed jacket, but not sort of running around going, wah! Cool. Whatever else people do whenever they're wearing tweeds. fishing. Whatever. So
anyway, yeah. I think that's it this week because we've been on a while, haven't we?
So over time. I'm so sorry, folks. We've just so much to talk about. If you want to talk to us in between times, give us feedback, give us opinions on what we're saying, either here or in between times. Then do so in, I guess you can get in touch with us on the podcast in all the usual ways. There's the website at motoringpodcast.com. There's Twitter @motoringpodcast. There is a Facebook page if if Facebook deigns to let you see it. And we've got personal Twitter as well. Andrew, how can people get in touch with you on Twitter?
I am at Crack Windscreen. And how about you, Alan?
I'm at AJP Bradley, all one word, on Twitter as well. So yeah, please do. Please engage us in conversation. Nothing we like more than that, particularly if you're not disagreeing with us. If you enjoyed the show and you've been listening to us on the podcast downloady way things, so Overcast, Downcast, iTunes, anything else with cast in the name, then if you could give us a rating and a review if possible, that would be fab. Even better than that would be to tell your mates about this really, really good motoring podcast there is called Motoring Podcast. And I think that just about sums it up. So until next time, I've been Alan Bradley.
I've been Andrew Clues.
And safe motoring.